You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio, your voice of football here in Australia and right around the world. I'm your host, Louise Taffa, and joining me in the studio is Josh Parrish. Josh, great to have you.
Good to be with you, Louise. Good evening. It's a wonderful evening here in Melbourne, and there's plenty of football to be discussed.
There is indeed. We'll hear from former FFA head of sports science, Dr. Craig Duncan, surrounding the intricacies of how an athlete like Usain Bolt adapts to becoming a professional footballer. We'll also hear from a journalist to chat about Q8 and give us insight into what we can expect ahead of their game against the Socceroos. And we'll also hear from a journalist from The Scotsman who will chat about the Socceroos' latest recruit, Martin Boyle. But plenty to get through tonight, Josh, and I believe you've got the latest news headlines.
Absolutely, I do. Kieran Backus is the big one. He's had his contract at Western Sydney Wanderers terminated by mutual consent. This comes just 3 weeks after his tantrum, his hissy fit, whatever you want to call it. He was not happy when he was substituted in the 57th minute. And he took off his shirt and threw it and stormed down the tunnel, created a bit of a stir at the time. There's been off-the-field issues that the club has tried to keep closed indoors. And over the past season or so, he wanted to leave, I think, back in January. And now he has got his wish. He's out the door and he's pulled up sticks at Melbourne City on a short-term injury replacement deal. So he's covering from Michael O'Halloran, who's, of course, out with that hamstring strain. So he'll only be able to play for 2 to 3 months until they work out a new contractual situation for him at City. But Kieran Backus out the door at the Wanderers and in at the Sky Blues.
Very interesting. Obviously, these... what do you call them, attitude issues, have been going on for quite some time, even when they had Gombau in charge of the Western Sydney Wanderers. And it's nothing new. I mean, how many times have we seen him, you know, act like that when being substituted?
Yeah, he's not a player who keeps his emotions really in check sometimes. He's always quite visible, but we don't know his side of the story either, so it's easy to be critical. If he has a better football situation at Melbourne City, well played to him. So, because there wasn't so long ago that we were talking about him in Socceroos contention with his performances in the A-League. It is interesting that, you know, he's left his brother behind at the Wanderers. I mean, we delighted in them playing alongside each other in central midfield. That will no longer be the case. So you wonder whether that'll be, obviously they're, you know, very close. You wonder if it'd be difficult for him without his brother, but obviously he's decided this is the best step for him to take in his career, and the club have acquiesced to his demands to leave. We must wait and see how it works out for him, but hopefully he'll be happier and be able to perform better at City.
Yeah, indeed. And it is only a short-term contract, as you touch on, injury replacement for Michael O'Halloran, who suffered a hamstring injury against, was it Brisbane Roar, in a pre-season friendly game. Very unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really unfortunate for him. He's going to be out for 2, maybe 3 months with a tear. So it sucks, really. Michael O'Halloran, he's been doing the business for Rangers over in Scotland. He's got great pedigree and apparently has bags and bags of pace. And coming back from a hamstring injury, you know, well into the season, is going to be tough for a player who relies on that pace. But in other news, Wellington Phoenix have been in the transfer market once again. They signed Max Burgess just yesterday from MPL, and now they've gone overseas for their latest recruit, picking up Armando Sosa Peña, the Spanish defensive midfielder from Almeria. He's been playing in the Spanish second division, the Segunda, and he's also had spells in the Primera division as well with Sporting Gijón. He's played for Elche and Real Madrid B as well. A lot of players come through at Real Madrid without necessarily playing for the first team, but the B team, you know, usually hovers around the second division and is, you know, extremely strong. So he's got some serious pedigree, and Mark Rudan said he watched him when he was over scouting in Europe and says he'll add a lot to the structure of the team, especially defensively.
Yeah, indeed. And Josh, do you think that now that Mark has made, you know, a couple of key signings, we can see Wellington doing better than they have in previous seasons?
It's tough because everybody in the A-League has improved so much. You know, see, the recruitment across the board has been absolutely outstanding, and Wellington are coming from, you know, a low base. They have had a lot of changes. I think it might take them a little while to bed in, but from what we saw in the FFA Cup, yes, they did go out to Bentley Greens, but they did have a very solid defensive foundation in that game, and it just felt like they needed to develop the attacking side of things. So he's obviously starting from the back, which is, you know, where they were really leaky last season. They've got Stephen Taylor, the former Newcastle United defender, who will be absolutely immense for them, I believe. And they just need to be able to, you know, put things together, be able to use possession effectively and score a few goals. And when you've got the likes of Roy Krischer and Nathan Burns and Sarpreet Singh in your team, you're going to be able to create some chances.
That's it. And I feel like that having heard a number of Wellington players speak last season when Nathan Burns incepted, was it halfway through, I think, when he arrived at the club, he provided a lot of leadership, as did Roy Krischer. So if they can link up well with some of the forwards, then I think that maybe we can see some more goals. And goals, obviously, the more you scored, hopefully you'll win games.
Yeah, well, we can only hope that they improve from last season. I don't think they're going to be in finals contention, in all honesty. I think they are still missing a really recognised out-and-out goal scorer. They've brought back David Williams, who's been playing over in Hungary, I believe. And Mitch Nichols can score goals as well, but again, not an out-and-out striker. So you wonder who's going to bang in the goals up front. They were linked to Obafemi Martins, but they decided not to pursue that because of his injury issues. So that's the one question really hanging over this side.
Yeah, indeed. A lot of questions that need answering for this Wellington side.
Absolutely. And in other news, South Melbourne have been sensationally accused of wage theft by current and former players and staff. This is FTBL with this exclusive article that's come out in the past half hour or so. The PFA has confirmed that some players have approached them with concerns over unpaid wages. There is one player who's actually come forward choosing to remain anonymous, but he is a current player, and he said, "I've tried to do everything the right way and to speak to them about it, and they just don't want a bar of it, so this was the last resort. It's not about me. I just know that there are boys that need the money a lot more than I do. Some of the guys rely on it, and it's just not fair. I need something to happen. The whole back office is a shambles. The club is in a bad way, and they will lose a lot of players during the off season, and that's why they're holding out the money, so I'm just trying to force their hand." South Melbourne has denied all the allegations. Leo Athanasakis, who's the outgoing president, has absolutely denied all charges, but there are some players such as Liam McCormick, who's currently with Dandenong City in MPL2, who's come out and agreed with he's a former South player, and he said he's still owed money from his last spell at the club. So potentially a systemic issue at South Melbourne.
Big issues, and certainly not what you want to hear for the A-League hopefuls.
Yeah, when they're going for an A-League license, this is absolutely the last thing they need. Controversy over unpaid wages, and given that the PFA suddenly has a lot more power in Australian football with the new Congress, I doubt they'll want South participating if these allegations turn out to be true.
Do you think it could affect their chances?
I think it definitely could. I'm not sure that we're going to get the license this time around anyway, just because of the baggage that comes with South Melbourne as, you know, old soccer, and I don't think that should be the case. Just to be clear, I don't think that should be a factor, but you know, there is FFA is usually likes to play to the mainstream media and try and get good coverage, and obviously over the years in terms of the NSL coverage and so forth, they wouldn't normally be very positive about covering teams like South Melbourne, who, you know, perceived to have ethnic ties and so forth. So I think that still affects things, even though it shouldn't. It shouldn't affect their bid, but this is an actual substantive issue that could really stand in the way of them having any chance of getting an A-League licence.
Indeed. There you go. The A-League aspirants South Melbourne have been accused of chronic wage theft by current and former players and staff.
Absolutely explosive allegations coming out. Good work to the team at FTBL for uncovering this, and we'll have to wait and see what comes of it. And finally, Usain Bolt will make his starting debut for the Central Coast Mariners tonight against a Southwest Sydney Select 11 coached by Nicky Carl. This is part of the Southwest Sydney MacArthur in expansion bid process and publicity campaign, and it's also raising money for a Parkinson's charity as well, the Shake It Up Foundation. So great to see by all parties concerned. But Usain Bolt is confirmed to be starting alongside Ross McCormack and Tommy Orr up front. And we're going to speak to Craig Duncan after the break, the former head of sports science at FFA, who's going to tell us about the barriers that Usain Bolt might face trying to transition from sprinting to an endurance sport like football.
We are indeed. You're listening to Evenings on FNR.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR. You're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And you can get involved in the program at any time by giving us a call on 03 9944 9999, or you can tweet to us at FNR underscore radio. Well, the Central Coast Mariners will start eight-time Olympic champion Usain Bolt in the club's preseason friendly tonight. And we caught up with the former FFA head of sports science, Dr. Craig Duncan, to discuss if Bolt can cut it as a professional footballer.
Dr. Craig Duncan, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome to Evenings on FNR.
Good. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, for people who might not be aware of you and your CV, give us a little bit about yourself, your qualifications and your involvement in football over the past few years.
I suppose most recently for the last World Cup cycle, I was head of sports science for the FFA and primarily and focused on the Socceroos. So from late 2014, from November 2014 through the Asian Cup into the World Cup qualifying and then into the World Cup. So that's where I was. And my academic background is through the sports science area, undergraduate degree in that, and then postgraduate degrees, and then PhD in sports science.
So you've got a whole list of achievements there. I mean, helping the Western Sydney Wanderers to the Asian Cup, the Asian Champions League Championship, and helping the Socceroos win the Asian Cup and qualify for the most recent tournament. I have to ask, were you behind the sci-fi anti-fatigue glasses on the plane?
Oh, yeah, I suppose that was, I mean, that comes under our work. So, yeah, it was anything like that. You look at what the problem is, or what you need to overcome. And with that trip, there was extensive fatigue and travel fatigue associated with it. And so you go and do your research and speak to some smarter people than me, and then put a whole program together to get you back in one piece. And yeah, those glasses, it's actually interesting. Those glasses, there's times when you travel where you need to be awake, and when you want to actually go to sleep. So those glasses shine light into your eyes to keep you awake, and then there's other glasses that you can use as you should be wanting to go to sleep, and they're a sort of a darker glass that block out blue light. So it's not rocket science, but it's a bit of fun. Yeah, and in actual fact, it works. So there's quite a bit of evidence about that. So,
Well, I think I probably needed a couple of pairs of those during the World Cup, Craig, trying to get my sleeve cycle in order. But we are here to talk about Usain Bolt today, the topic that, you know, he just keeps dominating the Australian football media. When you first saw this story about a professional sprinter trying to transition to a completely different sport, what was your thoughts on it? Do you think this is impossible, or this is a really interesting experiment?
Look, I think it's an interesting experiment more than anything. It's obviously difficult, but you're talking about the greatest sprinter of all time. So who's going to sit back and, I think, really criticise that? I think it's a good on him for actually having a go at doing it. It's obviously something that he really enjoys, and it's brought great publicity to our sport. But yes, from a physiological perspective and a technical perspective, there's a lot of difficulties, isn't there?
And Craig, what are some of the challenges that Usain Bolt faces transitioning from becoming, you know, a world-class sprinter to a professional footballer?
Well, football primarily is an intermittent sprint sport, so it has an aerobic base, and then, you know, there's a number of times throughout the game you've got to sprint and then relax and change speed. So that's very different from a 100-metre or 200-metre runner, where they actually increase their speed as they go along. And our sport is pretty much over, like, the maximum sprint you do on average is around about 15 metres, and the majority of them are just sharp accelerations and decelerations, so the change of direction. So it is extremely different to the sport that he's come from.
And in terms of this football fitness that we keep hearing about, that combination of, you know, small bits of sprinting and actually changing direction, accelerating and decelerating would put a lot of different stresses on the body than to what professional sprinting would.
Oh, absolutely. So yeah, they're very, very different sports. However, he's a very good athlete, and it's going to take time. And genetically and physiologically, there's probably a different makeup for him than there is in respect to most football players that have an aerobic base. So he's never had to work on his aerobic base because he's only been working over such a small distance. I'm not working with him, so I don't know physiologically exactly what his makeup is, and then in time he could develop that physiological base. Because I do remember reading a number of years ago that he was quite a good 400 meter runner as well, which means there isn't a more somewhat of an aerobic component to that. So who knows what he can do. I think you can never underestimate these great athletes with their mindset, and if he's got his mind put to it and he's managed correctly, it's not going to happen overnight, but who's to say it couldn't happen? But then you've got the whole technical components, which are another level. So who knows?
Well, developing the actual football skills is a totally different kettle of fish, Craig. But where do you start with an athlete like this? If Usain Bolt was working with you and said, I want to be a professional footballer, what would you start him on in terms of a training regimen to try and build up that aerobic base?
Well, with anything you do, you have to analyse the situation first and see where it is at. And I would expect that his aerobic capacity was probably quite low, and that's obviously where that you've got to put in the work. So in saying that, a lot of it can be done with football, you know, inside the football game as such, and training. So it just needs to be tailored that way, and the more he does it, the more we'd build up in that regard. Look, in saying that, there's a lot of football players that are playing at a high level now, particularly through their junior years, do not have that aerobic capacity and has to build up. And you can see them when they play. You think, okay, they can only play for short parts of time, and then it seems like they're out of the game for a fair while. So there's a lot of players that need to develop this aerobic capacity, and it absolutely can be done. So wherever he is now, he can improve. If that's to improve to the level that you need for football, is a different matter. The other load changes that are on the body, remember, you're going in one direction, and he's done that for the majority of his life, and now you've got those big changes of direction, change in acceleration, deceleration, and those movement patterns, which he will get just by training. But I did read where I think their coach said, let's have a see where he's at in January. And look, I would expect that you'll see continued improvements. What that looks like at the end of the day, if he can be a professional footballer at a decent level, who's to know?
And in terms of that agility training as well, I mean, you're saying a lot of this can be developed just in match practice, but would you be setting him on any kind of extracurricular tasks? I mean, you see all those videos of, you know, American footballers and so forth doing those running ladders and things like that, trying to change direction really quickly. Is that something that you'd be encouraging Bolt to take up?
No, not necessarily. I think he just needs to play in the context of football. So in the small-sided games, even in the passing practice, the possession games, all those are going to advance those specific movements, because you want to be as specific as possible to what we actually have to go and do. There might be some extra sort of work in his aerobic power, looking at doing some a number of four-minute type longer intervals. But again, they can be done with the ball, and we've seen through research that if we're doing those on a regular basis, that we can definitely build up that aerobic capacity. It doesn't mean that he has to go out for a half hour, 10, you know, even 15, 10-minute runs or anything like that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about keeping it all in the football context, because that's what we're trying to build as a football player.
Like, you know, when players go to have a medical at a club, what kind of elements would Bolt have to pass for that?
I'm not necessarily sure what their medical component. Normally, a medical just structurally and how they are, and make sure that everything's in line. It wouldn't get too much into the context of football. However, it depends on the club. I mean, there are some things we could look at. Of course, you'd look at his injury history and all that, and make sure everything's right cardiovascular wise, just from a health perspective for his own protection. They're pretty stock standard, the medical procedures there. But definitely you'd want to research his injury history. And look, he was such a high profile athlete, it was quite well known. A lot of sprinters have hamstring issues over time, just simply because of the high power they're putting through, and that would have to be managed. Look, any player that comes from overseas to Australia at any level, they're at risk of injury, because we play in a summer competition. Our pitches are a bit harder, and it needs to be managed, and players need to have that time to adapt to the training load. So it just means it needs to be a little bit more for him, but it can be done. I mean, definitely from wherever he's starting from, he can make vast improvements. So I have no doubt about that. However, as I said before, where that ends up, I'm not sure.
So do you think he's under any extra injury cloud or an injury risk, you know, being a 32-year-old athlete who has, you know, a lot of, well, maybe not that many miles on the body, but very quick 100-metre sprints on his body quite over the course of his career, and then trying to radically change his training regimen and his type of fitness. Does that put him at any extra risk of injuries?
Oh, absolutely. But every player that you have, what we do is classify them in respect to their injury risk. And simply being over the age of 30, we've found that increases your injury risk. Being a high-powered athlete, high fast twitch fiber, so a sprint athlete as such, he again is at injury risk. However, that's no different from any other player in the A-League or any other competition around the world. So we would do the same with any of the clubs that we consult to, is to put have a look at the categorisation of each player in respect to the injury. So it's no different, and to any overseas player that's come here at 30 years of age. And you always see, if you look back and you look now, overseas players are at risk. As players get older, they're at risk. High sprint athletes are at risk, and he's just one of those. It can be managed. I mean, that's just good management, really.
Well, Craig, this might be slightly outside of your remit, but, you know, in your experience of both sports science and football, is there a position you could see him playing on the park that would be easier for him to adjust to?
Look, obviously you want to use his speed, don't you? And you think, okay, which players do run the most in respect to, you know, getting up that high speed? And you look at the wide areas of the field, that's where they get up to. However, those players also have to do the most work. So they're the ones that actually have to have the high aerobic capacity and be fast. So they're the best, probably, or the highest working athletes on the field. So your wide defenders and your wide attackers. So it depends on what system they're playing. I think centrally would be quite difficult. I suppose a lot of people would think, okay, why don't we just kick the ball over the top and get him to run for it? It's not that simple, because football is a very small sport, I suppose, in respect to the distances.
Yeah.
So it's not going to happen that way. But obviously the wide areas, there's more space if we want to get into those spaces. But I'm a sports scientist, not a coach.
Craig, something that came up in last night's show was the negative impact and adverse effects of having a player like 15-year-old Mary Fowler playing with the women's national team. Just your thoughts and stance on this.
In respect to her age?
Yeah,
in respect to her age.
Look, in women's football, we've seen that happen before. But again, I'm very much, even though it's a team sport, I treat people as individuals. I haven't worked with her before, so I'm not sure where she is at physiologically and psychologically. There are issues that need to be addressed. However, I have worked extensively with the head coach of the Matildas, and I have confidence in him in respect to who he is choosing. So I think we've seen it before with Ellie Carpenter. I think we've seen it with Kaya Simon. I think we've seen it in the women's game with a number of these players. They need to be managed well, physiologically and psychologically. And look, the Matildas head coach, he knows the women's game in this country better than anyone, and the players, and he wouldn't make that decision irrationally. And he's also worked extensively with younger players throughout his career.
Craig, it's been absolutely enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us here on Evenings on FNR.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, and that's former FFA Head of Sports Science, Dr. Craig Duncan, chatting to us a little bit earlier, Josh. And he expects you'd see continued improvement from Usain Bolt as he continues to train and work harder to become a professional footballer.
Absolutely. I mean, the technical side of things is a whole different kettle of fish, but he doesn't think there's any real reason why Usain Bolt can't continue to, as long as the club are patient with him, can't continue to gradually improve on a physical performance side of things. And I think that's really important for Bolt if he's going to actually make the grade, because as we saw in his substitute appearance last time out for the Mariners, he looked pretty gassed after about 10 minutes.
Yeah, he did indeed. As we touched on, other things that really need improving are his first touch and awareness of the game and ability to link up with other players.
And all things that become harder when you're physically fatigued. So interesting to hear from Craig, and we're going to be touching base with him again throughout the course of the season on various high-performance subjects. He's a very well-credentialed man who's helped Western Sydney Wanderers win an Asian Champions League and the Socceroos win an Asian Cup. So I can't think of anyone better to speak on the subject.
You and I both, yes. And it was interesting to get his thoughts on Mary Fowler. And something that we discussed last night on the program, we had a former Matilda on, and she was raising the issues and concerns around having a 15-year-old player in and amongst the women's national team and what that is doing to her childhood and basically stripping her of her childhood.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear from Joey Peters. I went back and listened to the podcast of that one, Louise. And she's very outspoken on all these sorts of subjects. And we've also had lots of reaction to that segment online. With the likes of Frances Awaratifi has come out and said it's really important for, you know, kids to be allowed to be kids. And, you know, also the mental strain as well is a factor that you need to play into it. But hopefully Mary Fowler is being, you know, treated with kid gloves, even though she is such a prodigious talent and isn't going to suffer injuries as a result of her early start.
Well, that's it. And as you heard Dr. Craig Duncan say, these types of players need to be managed really well.
And everyone's physiology is different.
Well, that's it. That's it. And he also said that, you know, the Matildas head coach, Alan Stajic, doesn't really make decisions like this very lightly.
Absolutely. Well, we will go to a break, Louise. When we come back, we're going to have a little bit of a chat on the current state of things in the A-League, and then we're going to have some power and passion with Chris Pine, the New South Wales coach of the Cerebral Palsy football team. They've got their national championships going on right now. They actually played today, and they're a very successful team in that field. So looking forward to hearing from Chris. That's all coming up after the break here on Evenings on FNR.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR, and you're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And just before the break, we were talking about 15-year-old Mary Fowler, one of the young players coming through the ranks for the women's national team here in Australia. And if you want to read up on Mary and some of the quotes that a former Matilda said only last night on the show, you can head to FNR's website, and there's an article on there. And Josh, we're going to switch our focus to the A-League. How much do you read into pre-season friendlies? Because Melbourne Victory have lost 2-1 to Adelaide United behind closed doors, and it was only last week that they lost to Wellington Phoenix as well.
I read almost nothing into pre-season friendlies, especially in the A-League. A lot of the time, the squads aren't really settled until a few rounds into the season, especially with the new imports coming through. So it's not something I'd be hugely concerned by as a Melbourne Victory fan myself. Also, Victory are notoriously slow starters. They, you know, they had a poor start to the season last time out. They ended up coming away with an unlikely A-League championship. Though, it's important to note that, you know, it was a bit of a championship against the odds. They were by far, far, far away from the best team in the A-League. You know, they probably weren't even the fourth best team over the course of the season. The position of the table probably flattered them, but they were able to bring it on the day. So I wouldn't be concerned about pre-season friendlies, but I do think Melbourne Victory, you know, if they finished, what was it, 27 points behind Sydney in the table last season, something to that degree. So that's, you know, that's not really good enough from Victory's perspective. And the finals triumph has covered over some of the cracks.
Yeah, what do you think are some of the concerns for Melbourne Victory heading into this season? Do you think there are any?
I think there definitely are. The back line is still a big question mark for me. They have brought in dedicated fullbacks in Corey Brown and Storm Rue, but whether those players are, you know, of the requisite level for a club like Melbourne Victory, who wants to be winning titles each and every season and trying to progress in the Asian Champions League, I'm not sure. Storm Rue hasn't been the same player since his injury issues, and, you know, he is another player who relied on a lot of pace to recover. So, and and so forth. So and Corey Brown is, you know, he's been a solid, consistent A-League option. He did have some injury concerns as well, but I suspect that Lee Broxham will be playing in one of those fullback positions by the end of the season. He won't start there, mm-hmm. but he will finish the season there. And then the other point of concern is on the wing, where Leroy George has departed the club.
That's it. There's a bit of a hole there now.
Yeah, and James Troisi, from the looks of things, if they keep the same formation, is going to have to move out wide, where he used to play back when he was a younger player and in the Newcastle youth teams and so forth, playing out in the left wing, because Kasuke Honda is hardly going to be playing on the wing. I think he's going to be in the number 10 role. So Troisi, you know, he's lost a bit of pace and he has had inconsistent form. He didn't really live up to expectations last season. There's big questions over him and whether he can adapt to a different role.
And it'll all be tested next week when they take on Melbourne City in the Melbourne Derby. What a way to kick off the season.
Absolutely. It's going to be a fascinating occasion. Melbourne City, unfortunate to not come into this game really full strength with Michael O'Halloran suffering that injury, but they do have Kieran Backus, as we mentioned off the top of the show, signing just today. I do wonder with Melbourne City whether they should be bringing in sort of higher profile, higher caliber players, given that we know they've got an enormous operating budget behind them in terms of, you know, the ownership structure. So obviously they do a lot of great stuff off the field. They've got a great training base and so forth. But you just wonder whether the marquee player options, I mean, Richie Delatt, he's a player of good pedigree, but he's not exactly going to set the world on fire in terms of attendances. And Bruno Fornaroli, he's a known quantity in the A-League at this point. You kind of expected when the City Football Group took over that they were going to bring in, you know, galactic superstars, but really it's been Victory who's made the splashes in the off-season with Honda and Toivonen.
Certainly you would have seen that their crosstown rivals would have poached someone big from overseas. Who would have you liked to see Melbourne City sign?
Oh, well, it's difficult to pick out, you know, one player who's willing to come to the A-League. You know, obviously it's difficult to compete in terms of salaries with even clubs in Asia and so forth. But, you know, you saw Adelaide with their recruiting. You've got to take a little bit of a creative approach. They've picked up Ken Ilso, who's a very highly rated Danish player, and he wanted to come down to Australia because he likes travelling the world with his football, and he wanted to go, you know, cage diving with sharks, and apparently you can only do that here in Australia and in South Africa. So that was one of the main reasons he came to the A-League. You've got to find players who are willing to come here for the lifestyle as well. So it's difficult to just, you know, pick out global names. I mean, like the likes of Samuel Eto'o and Giuseppe Rossi and Claudio Marchisio are some of the players who were off contract, but, you know, most of those guys have been snapped up at this point.
And remember the old rumours about Andres Iniesta?
Oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean, he would have been fantastic, but he's still absolutely top class, and you've seen that with some of his performances in the J-League. Even playing for a team who's not, you know, one of the top sides in the J-League, he's been able to pull out absolutely fantastic goals and assists pretty much each and every week. So if the league could snap up someone like him, it would do a lot for the general publicity, at least in the short term.
Now, my question for you is, how will Melbourne City utilise Kieran Backus when they already have Riley McGree?
Yes, and they already got Luke Bratton as well. So I'm wondering where he fits into the side. They seem to be pretty stocked in terms of central midfield players. And you know, Dario Vizic, he tends to play a little bit further forward, but he's another one clogging up the centre of midfield there. I don't think Kieran Backus is going to start straight off the bat, because it seems as if Luke Bratton is absolutely unshakable in terms of that central midfield position. He was one of their key players last season. I think he finished second in the Fox Sports Player of the Year voting. And Riley McGree, you know, he's one of the biggest Australian young talents going around, who hasn't made his way abroad, or really made inroads abroad, I should say. And they've also got Roston Griffiths, let's not forget, who's come over from Central Asia and is the kind of player that Warren Joyce is going to want to rely upon. So I don't see Kieran Backus as a starter, I'm afraid.
Maybe just having a little bit more cover,
yeah,
just in case.
Seems to be a depth player, which is weird, because you would have thought he'd want first-team football at this stage in his career, but maybe this is a stopgap solution on injury replacement, and he might be moving on to pastures new maybe overseas once this contract finishes.
Well, that's it. We have mentioned that it is only a short-term injury replacement for Michael O'Halloran. And something else that really sparked my attention was why City would sign him, other than the fact that he's a short-term injury replacement, given the off-field issues.
He doesn't really fit their needs, does he?
No.
In terms of in positionally, I mean, unless you play Riley McGree further up the field or out wide, which he can do, he's quite versatile in that regard. And then you could potentially play a midfield three of Griffiths, Bratton and Backus. And that gives you quite a lot of control in the centre of midfield. But, you know, that will push other players who you'd probably like to see starting out of the team. You know, you can't fit Dario Vidicic in there, assuming you're playing Florent Berenguer and Bruno Fornaroli up front. So you can't fit them all in. I suspect there might be a bit of a rotation.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about former Western Sydney Wanderers attacking midfielder Kieran Backus, who has parted ways with his former club. And I'm very interested to know why, other than as a short-term injury replacement, because he's had a few off-field issues, a few issues surrounding his attitude. There was one match. Was it against... I think it was against Melbourne City.
It was
against Melbourne City. That's right.
It's interesting that. I wonder whether he thought he'd rather be, storming into the other dugout.
Maybe. But we actually have Mark Bosnich on the topic.
Look, I don't like it. I'd rather him, you know, at least go to the other player to say, like, I understand it being upset at the manager, but me personally, and like I said, look, everyone's different, but I was brought up in a way that when I was a young apprentice at Manchester United, where if you did that, you'd be in big trouble. So that kind of sticks with you, and you are the product of your experiences, but each to their own, I guess. But haven't they had problems with him before?
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, and with thanks to Fox Sports, that is Mark Bosnich chatting about Kieran Backus.
I'm not sure Bosnich should have too much to say on the topic, if I'm honest. He was a bit of an enfant terrible in his, during his time in England, as we're led to believe. But, yeah, obviously, he didn't like it. I don't think the Wanderers liked it, and I don't think Marcus Babbel liked it. He didn't like what he saw, and he's not, you know, willing to put up with players who are, you know, publicly displaying their emotions in that kind of disrespectful manner. So out the door he goes, but it leaves the Wanderers with a massive hole in central midfield. And we're going to see, I think, a lot of Costa Grozos, who's a young scholarship player. He's really only just come up from the youth team. He's only 18, but he's already been starting in FFA Cup games and looks the part. I'm very impressed with him. What do you see in Grozos, Louise? Do you think he's ready for plenty of first team football this season?
I do, but I think there's one other player ahead of him, and it's 19-year-old Mark Tokic. He came. He's a Canberra local, and he is a central midfielder. Now, he didn't play in the FFA Cup match. I think he could be dealing with a niggly injury at the moment.
Okay.
But he is outstanding, and he has a big future ahead of himself. So I think we will be seeing a lot of him this season.
In the Sydney game, in the Sydney Derby semi-final, you really saw a lack of control in central midfield when they were under pressure. They didn't really have anyone to put their foot on the ball and just calm things down. And you look through the squad, there isn't really a stable, experienced defensive midfield option in the squad at all. It's mostly either young players or creative players. I mean, they have brought in Jordan O'Doherty from Adelaide United, but again, he's only 20 years old. So I do wonder if they're going to struggle in that position, and they're going to have to really have some leadership from the players behind them, especially Brendan Hamill, the new captain, and Patrick Ziegler, their German import, as well as Alexander Baumjohann, who's, you know, more of a creative player, but has heaps of football experience at the very highest level. So he's going to need to mentor these young guys like Tokic and Grozos to try and get them up to the level required for Wanderers to make the finals.
Definitely. And Tokic has had a good grounding. He worked on his craft at the FFA Centre of Excellence. He has represented Australia at the youth national team level. He was just unfortunate not to make the current young Socceroos squad, who are over in Singapore at the moment as they begin their qualifiers for the under-20 FIFA World Cup next year in Poland. As I said, I think he's dealing with a minor injury. However, I think that if he can come into some form this season and step up his game, and I know he has been training with the first team for quite some time now, so he's in a good space. I think he can definitely make impact for the Western Sydney Wanderers in the central midfield this season.
Just on that, do you think it's sometimes a hindrance, players going over to play for youth national teams and losing time at their clubs? Do you think it, not in terms of their development necessarily, but in terms of, you know, know, the standing they're held in at their club and how much faith, you know, especially a foreign coach like Marcus Babbel coming in and seeing these new players, you know, if they're jetting off to play qualifiers in Southeast Asia or what have you, and the new coaches don't get a lot of time with them to see what they can do, do you think that leads to less first team appearances?
It depends who's coaching. For example, last season with Marco Kurz, we had quite a lot of A-League clubs coming out and saying, you know, they wouldn't release any of their players for internationals, which was, I find it's absurd.
Yeah, I think so too. But you do wonder whether these foreign coaches, you know, they really need some face-to-face, you know, training time to see the likes of Tokic playing their football, if they're going to have any faith in them going into the season, especially in this critical period, you know, a couple of weeks leading up to the season. You know, maybe if it's mid-season, they already know what they can do. They're happy to, you know, wave them away and they can go play for the Young Socceroos or what have you. But, you know, getting that initial, you know, first impression down pat seems to be very important for young players if they're going to get any first team football in the A-League.
You're right, and I think touching back on Marco Kurz, it was midway through the season that the youth national teams were calling in players for some of the qualifiers, and Marco Kurz came out and said he has no issue with it.
Yeah, that's good as well.
He said because, he respects that the players are at the level that they are going to be called into a youth national team, and he was happy to release them because, you know, it's something that is a positive for their development.
And that's good to see, especially considering, I think at that point, Adelaide United had a massive injury crisis. So they actually had to pick some of the youth players that weren't selected for the teams. So that shows, you know, sort of consistency of mentality from Kurz that this is important and it's not just, you know, when it suits them.
Well, that's it. And I think it also highlights another issue as to how A-League coaches build in the preseason. Mm. It's very important. And if you can map out and factor in things like the players going away on international duty, then you can build a squad that has depth and you can fill the places when need be.
Absolutely. Well, Louise, we could talk about this all night, but we must take a short break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, the coach of the New South Wales Cerebral Palsy football team, Chris Pine, is going to join us from the National Cerebral Palsy Championships. This is Evenings here on FNR with Josh Parrish and Louise Taffer.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR and you're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And Josh, you caught up with someone a little bit earlier.
Absolutely. It's time for some power and passion with the coach of the New South Wales Cerebral Palsy football team, Chris Pine. They're in the midst of their national championships and they've put a fair few goals past their opponents. Let's hear from Chris now.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us and welcome to Evenings on FNR.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Tell me, how long have you been involved with Paralympic cerebral palsy football?
Well, the program started in 98 and I was one of the first. So we played our first international in 99, so best part of 20 years.
And how did you initially get involved?
I used to do AWD, which is Athletes with a Disability Athletics, and before the 2000 Paralympics, the then Australian coach decided to start up a team and gave me a call and said would your son rather play football than be a runner? And of course I said yes, because I'd played football since I was a wee tyke. So I said yes straight away, and then we went on to play in the Ukraine in 99, and then the Paralympics in 2000, which was an awesome experience.
Fantastic. And when did you start getting involved in coaching and with the New South Wales side?
Yeah, so I got involved in coaching would have been about 10 years ago through the Cerebral Palsy Alliance. And we started up the New South Wales state program, but we also started up a development program as well. So through the Cerebral Palsy Alliance, we found a whole bunch of kids with cerebral palsy, and we just went, you know what, this is too good to be true, and so started coaching, and then started playing, and And I mean, it's one of the greatest things when you see one of those young boys run on the pitch next to you. So that's a feather in everyone's cap. So lots of different people have been working harder than New South Wales programs to get it up and running, and we're reigning champions. So we're very, very happy about that.
That's fantastic, Chris. And how does coaching players with cerebral palsy differ to, you know, mainstream coaching?
Yeah, I've been asked this on several occasions, and it just doesn't. It just doesn't. Yeah. You do exactly the same thing. So I've also coached an able-bodied team, and I did exactly the same drill. So there's no difference. There's small barriers that you need to get over, and there's obviously different rules with actual Paralympic football. But in terms of the coaching, nothing changes. You're teaching to play hard and play well, and play the beautiful game. So it doesn't change at all.
Chris, I'm actually really happy to hear that, because that's one of the things we love about our game, is that it is so universal and so easily applicable across, you know, different groups of people. It's, you know, it's a ball and a couple of sets of sticks or jumpers, and then you're away.
Absolutely, and that's why it's a world game, because it's that easy. It's a ball. As long as you've got a ball, you can be entertained for hours on end, whether it be juggling or playing a little, you know, two-sided match, or, you know, 1v2. The game has taken me to a lot of different places and been responsible for some pretty amazing opportunities for me and my fellow players. So we just love the sport, mate.
And I know the you say the coaching doesn't differ at all, but what about the significance of football in the lives of, you know, these you guys with people living with cerebral palsy? Is it a really important sort of support network to have that team spirit around you and have players that and teammates who are going through much the same thing as you?
100%. So my story is no different to any of these players that I'm currently watching run around the park. I'm WA playing Vic at the moment. So, mate, the family environment that you get when you're playing with and around players with cerebral palsy, it's unlike any other team that I've ever been with, and I've been with able-bodied teams and things like that. But this is, it's completely different. And one of the young boys who is now one of the starters for the Pararoos, his comment was, "I wouldn't know where I've been if I didn't have football." So we teach young boys, you know, confidence. We also teach them about life and how to get a job, how to how to talk to girls, because there's a lot of barriers and a lot of things in society, and there's a sort of stigma around disabled players and around the way they're treated within their respective states. But I mean, watching this game now, I see as much heart as I've ever seen in a bunch of footballers. That, you know, it's a joy to watch. It really is.
It's really inspiring, Chris. But let's talk about the actual championships. You've kicked off with an emphatic 10-0 victory over Capital Football, and now you've netted a 2-0 victory over your arch rivals, Victoria. I believe you also had a game today.
Yes, we played two games today. Actually, we played Capital again, and we beat them 6. I think it's 6-0, and another one of our arch rivals, WA, we beat them 5-1. So I was I'm the goalkeeper, so I was absolutely filthy about letting that one goal in. I was going for the clean sheet, but we're looking very strong. New South Wales is looking very strong in this tournament, and you know, I mean, yes, you know, we come into into tournament favourites, and it's often hard to come in with a favourite tag. We'd love to play with the underdog tag, but we're often the ones where the other team decides to play a Jose Mourinho style and park the bus. So it's sometimes a bit tricky to score in, you know, when you're playing against that. But we've got a very talented squad, and we'll go a long way in this competition.
Well, the results certainly bear that out. I believe the gold medal match is taking place this Sunday at 11 a.m, and I can only assume that New South Wales will be involved. Can you give the people some details if they want to come down and watch?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's at Valentine Sports Park at Glenwood in Sydney. Starts at 11. If you want to see football, if you want to see players, you know, putting absolutely everything on the line, there's nothing better to watch. The final will be an absolute ripper.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us. You've painted a real fantastic picture, and best of luck for the rest of the competition.
Thank you so much, mate.
Coach of the New South Wales Cerebral Palsy football team, Chris Pine. He's also the goalkeeper, and they're looking to defend their crown. The gold medal match will be this weekend, so make sure you get down. But Louise, I believe you have some breaking news out of Melbourne City.
Yes, and Melbourne City's team news are in against, they're playing the Western Sydney Wanderers, and guess who's starting?
Bacchus?
He is.
Oh, wow. They're playing against Western Sydney.
They are playing against the Western Sydney Wanderers, and Kieran Bacchus, who has just been released from the club, is starting
against them. That is the most A-League thing I've ever heard in my life. The roundabout of players changing clubs, just a few hours after he signed, he's already playing against his former team. Louise, you got to keep us posted with updates from that friendly game, because, I mean, a red card, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility.
No, I don't think so. But I can tell you that some Malik, who received quite a few red cards last season, he is not in the starting 11.
So probably a relief for all concerned there. Louise, we must take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk Socceroos, and we're going to hear from Q8. The Socceroos play Q8 on Tuesday morning at 3:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, and Mohamed Fayed from Akhtaf Mi, who is one of the foremost Middle Eastern football writers and one of the only websites in English where you can get some quality Middle Eastern football news. Mohamed is going to join us after the break to give us a preview of Q8. This is Evenings here on FNR with Josh Parrish and Louise Taffer.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR, and you can get involved at any time by tweeting to us at FNR_radio, or you can give us a call on 03 99 99 99. We've been talking the Socceroos lately in the program, Josh, and we are about to hear from one of the journalists to chat about Q8.
Absolutely. Akhtaf Mi is the website, one of the only sources for Middle Eastern football. It's available in English. Mohamed Fayed is the man I caught up with earlier today to chat about the Q80 national team. Now, they were actually suspended by FIFA for over 2 years, so this is one of the first games they've played since being reinstated back in December last year. It's been a very tumultuous time in Q80 football, and Mohamed had the scoop.
Mohamed, thanks so much for joining me. The Socceroos will take on Q8 on Tuesday morning at 3:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. But it's been a turbulent period for the Q80 national team over the past couple of years. They were suspended by FIFA due to governmental interference. Could you give us a bit of background on that?
Yes, definitely. First of all, thank you so much for this opportunity. Now, with the Kuwaiti national team, there was just a myriad of problems happening within the FA itself, with the way the players were getting registered, with the way government was interfering within the happenings of the Kuwaiti League. And that is obviously banned from FIFA. The government's not allowed to interfere in the way the FA actually deals with situations in the league, and that's what was happening. But in late 2017, the ban was lifted, and Kuwait hosted the Gulf Cup of Nations, which they did poorly in, but they have been coming back slowly with friendlies to try and rebuild their national team for the following World Cup and Asian Cup qualifiers after 2019.
And it was due to some meddling from some high-profile members of the, you know, the Q80 Football Association and so forth, trying to elevate themselves to the FIFA Executive Committee. Is that correct?
Yeah, once I even did on Ahdaf, I wrote an in-depth article on it. It was just conspiracy theories from everywhere. So whether it was the president, Al-Fahad, president of the Kuwait FA, and his brother Ahmed Al-Fahad, who had links with FIFA, and both were trying to actually push, have their own agenda to get a place in FIFA. So it was very complicated in that sense, and it came to a point where the Kuwaiti people, whether it was fans or even people from the players and the managers and coaches, they started to go against the FA and what they were standing for, and that's when Fawaz Al-Hassawi, who was the former owner, president of Nottingham Forest, and he took control of the Kuwait FA on an interim basis at that point.
So it was due to popular pressure that this governmental interference was overturned and Q8 was able to be reinstated last year.
Yeah, and obviously there was, at that point it was very controversial after the Gulf issues with Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Both were trying to get credit for the fact that Kuwait got their ban uplifted. It was that period after, obviously, the Gulf crisis. Saudi Arabia, Saturk al-Sheikh, the head of the General Sports Authority, said, you know, we have credit for helping Kuwait, but then Qatar said the same thing too. So it just turmoil all over the Gulf footballing scene at that point.
How has the FIFA suspension affected Q80 football? I imagine, you know, it's really stunted the development of a lot of players not being able to play internationally or play in, you know, Asian continental competitions through their clubs.
Yeah, Kuwait has always been known as an underrated nation in the Arab world. Even though they have never pushed above their weight, they've always been known to develop very good players. Obviously, Badr Mutawa was about to play his 150th game, if I'm not mistaken, against Australia, so international game. He's one of the players who never had the chance to actually go play abroad because of the issues that were found in Kuwaiti football long before this ban. So there's always been an issue with players. Once the ban came into play, this obviously stunted youth development all the way to senior development, so it was very hard in every sense, and I think the biggest issue for Kuwaiti football fans at that point was how they would develop the younger players, because before, if Kuwaiti football was doing bad, the younger players would go to play in neighboring countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia and develop there. But at the point of the ban, it just stunted everything, and little concentration was placed on those young players.
You mentioned there one of the legends of Q80 football, the all-time cap holder, Badr Al-Mutawa, who is playing his 150th game, and he's had some of his prime years really robbed of him due to this ban. What kind of a player is he, and why should we look out for him in this friendly?
Well, obviously, you guys may have heard of Omar Abdulrahman, the Messi of Asia. Badr Al-Mutawa is probably the guy who everyone thinks is like, you know, he should have been the Omar Abdulrahman of the Gulf. He's actually the best player, but he never got the chance. So he had trials in England and Spain, but he never was able to move there. Even with the help of Al-Hassawi, who was president of Nottingham Forest, he was never able to finalize his move. And at the same time, Kuwaiti football didn't have the same attention as Emirati football, because Emirati football would bring in big foreign players. Obviously, there's been even Australian players who've been in the UAE League, but the Kuwaiti League on a much lesser level. So he had the chance to play on the national team level. Now, Badr Mutawa is a player, like, he's like a false nine, a striker. He's everything you want in an attacker. He's very hard to mark, very skillful. And until this day, he's 33 years old now, and he's still playing very well in the Kuwaiti League. But at the same time, the level of the league is not that great to really be evaluating him compared to the rest of the players in the region.
Yes, you mentioned his trials in England. He actually did have trials at Nottingham Forest, possibly due to that ownership situation that you mentioned earlier, but was unable to get a work permit, which is an issue that plagues so many Asian footballers trying to make it in European leagues, especially in England. But what are some of the other players we should look out for in this Q80 squad? Obviously, a lot of new faces considering the turmoil that the national team has been through.
Yeah, so now with the new coach, Romeo Jozak, he's actually aiming to, you know, not bring in, obviously they've not brought in any young players from the Olympics because they still have their friendlies, but he's kept, you know, the same basis of the squad that we would have seen from Kuwait had they qualified for the Asian Cup. The main players, obviously, all three goalkeepers, Al-Khalaf, Rashidi and Abdul Ghafur, all play for big clubs in Kuwait, and they're all, you know, the best that Kuwait has to offer. Abdul Ghafur probably will be the starter because he played against Lebanon yesterday. You also have defenders like Fahad Al-Hajri and Amal Matouk, who have been very experienced playing in the last Asian Cup and World Cup qualifiers when Kuwait were getting closer and closer but were affected by the Shaban. You have central midfielder Fahad Al Ansari, so he was playing for the big Saudi club Al Ittihad last season, and he's obviously also been excellent in Kuwait with the best club Al Qadsiyah. So these guys are the best players. And there's a young player, born in 95, he is Abdullah Maui, so he's the central attacking midfielder. He played yesterday, so getting his first few caps for Kuwait. He plays also for Qadsiyah, but he's always been a young prospective player, and now he finally gets his chance in the national team. So he's one to look at too.
That last player was Abdullah Maui, who's was that his first cap against Lebanon?
Yep.
Yeah, fantastic. And Kuwait came away with a 1-0 victory, a rare good result for them in the past few years, of course. But what about their coach, Romeo Hozak, the Croatian, or born in the former Yugoslavia? Is it a tendency for Kuwaiti teams to bring in foreign coaches, especially the national team, or have they had homegrown coaches in the past?
Well, for the national team, in the league recently, they have been hiring more local coaches, especially after the issues with Kuwaiti football. But on the national team level, it's mainly been managers, especially from that region of Europe. So even like at the top clubs, we've seen Florian Motrok and Boris Bunyak, they've always been at the top of Kuwaiti football. And just like the other Gulf nations, they really have a tendency to trust in the foreign manager more than the local manager.
And is that a controversial topic? Because it's something we discuss in Australia a lot, whether the Socceroos should have a foreign coach or whether it really should be a local who understands the footballing context.
Well, yeah, it's always been in the Gulf the biggest talking point. Do we trust in the local players and managers, or do we trust in the foreign players and managers? But no matter what has happened, no matter how many rules have been placed, for example, a quota on players and this and that, the trust has always been from owners of clubs and the presidents of the associations in the foreign managers. And this is partly due to because of the fact that, you know, obviously the coaching courses and et cetera that are in Kuwait, in the Gulf, in general, they're not of that quality and they don't support the local coaches as much. So the local coaches aren't ready because of the fact that they're not being prepared for it from the beginning, you know?
Absolutely. And what are some of the changes you'd like to see in Kuwaiti football to lead them in the right direction after coming out of the international wilderness, had their suspension lifted last December? What do you think the Football Association and the country needs to start doing to get itself back on track and being able to give these talented players that they produce real pathways?
Well, obviously, as I said, the national team is still seeing around 90% of the same players, no matter how old they are, back into the same place. Kuwaiti football needs to go back down from the grassroots and start rebuilding again. There's no better time to rebuild than now. There's no pressure on them to achieve anything, obviously, because of the ban. But now is the time, the best time to start a new project for Kuwaiti football all the way from the bottom is at this stage, so they can prepare for not just the 2022 World Cup, but even if they want to qualify for their first World Cup all the way in 2026. And because Kuwaiti football has always, as I said, been always had potential, but never been that team that you think would get the Asian Cup or get the qualify for the World Cup in recent years.
Mohammed, you've been fantastically informative. Thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to catching up with you and some of your colleagues from ADAF in future editions of the show.
Definitely. Thank you very much for your opportunity.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, and that was Mohammed Fayed. Josh caught up with him a little bit earlier to chat about Kuwait and the country. Incredibly, after 782 days, they had their FIFA ban lifted, which was back in December 2017, after 2 years. And basically what the journalist was saying was it killed off a generation.
A lot of players were denied opportunities at their peak. What was interesting, though, is I assumed there'd be so many new faces coming in after the ban, but apparently they've retained about 90% of the players that were previously in the national team and who are, you know, 2-3 years older. So what Mohammed was saying there is they need to actually blood way more youth players and really start from scratch in regards to, you know, how they're developing footballers. Kuwait is always, you know, really punched above their weight in terms of the size of the country. You know, they qualified for the World Cup back in 1982 and memorably walked off the field after a refereeing decision went against them. So, but they're a country with a rich footballing history, and it would be great to see them really climbing back up the football pyramid in the Gulf, because they do have some really talented players.
Well, that's it. And of course, any country that receives a ban from FIFA, their ranking suddenly drops, and it affects affects them in all different ways. And I don't think that the Kuwaitis realised that it would last so long.
I don't think so either, but there are a lot of problems with corruption in terms of the Football Association, the governmental interference in the sport that led to the ban. So there's some really systemic issues, and it ended up being grassroots pressure from below that ended up overturning the ban and overturning some of those people who were in charge. We can only breathe a sigh of relief as Australians that we didn't get that same sort of FIFA interference, ban from governmental interference that was looming over us in regards to some of the Congress debacles.
Well, that's it. And we know how strict FIFA are when it comes to government interference. We've only recently seen back in August, the Uruguayan FA had a few issues, and FIFA implemented a normalisation committee.
Don't mess with FIFA. They're pretty strict with regards to their regulations. That's the moral of the story.
And one other thing that I took away from the interview was something that we actually discussed on the program a couple of nights ago in regards to coaching. And one of the biggest talking points in the golf is whether or not to have a native coach or a foreign coach. And Muhammad was saying usually they opt for a foreign coach because they have a bit more quality and they're more prepared.
Yes, and I think it's just a perception as well in the Middle East. You've got a lot of clubs with quite rich owners, but they don't necessarily have a particular plan in place. And so they'll go for high-profile foreign players who, sometimes are there to work hard and achieve things, and sometimes they're there to just pick up a paycheck. And the same goes for foreign coaches. I think, especially in Asia, there are exceptions. Of course, Australia did so well under Gus Hiddink. Japan have had some great foreign coaches in the past. But I think Asian sides, across the region, need to start hiring local coaches who understand the football in context, who actually respect the domestic league and don't just pick players who play outside of the country, and who are invested in the long-term future of those countries, because you see these guys jet in and jet out. They don't really care about anything other than the year or so that they're in charge and the results during that period, and they're not building for the future.
That's it, and I'm a firm believer that you need to hire from within, especially when it comes to the national teams.
I would mostly agree with that. Obviously, there's exceptions with regard to circumstances. If you don't have the right coach available in a local context, sometimes you do have to look abroad. But in general, two coaches of equal quality, I would always go for the local in regards to especially the national teams.
We are going to take a quick break, but plenty more coming up.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Evenings on FNR. You're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish, and we are going to take a deeper look into the Socceroos and one player in particular, Josh.
Absolutely. Martin Boyle is a new call-up to the squad. He's a man who's never actually set foot on Australian shores, but I believe his father is Australian. He's currently playing for Hibernian over in Scotland alongside a couple of other Socceroos in terms of Jamie McLaren and Mark Milligan. What kind of player is Martin Boyle? Well, he's a quick direct winger, and he spoke to the Socceroos media team today about, he actually described his own game.
Yeah, I would say I'm fast, really fast at the moment. But I always try to work on that. I've got an eye for goal. I like to dribble with the ball. I like to take people on. I like to get in behind defenders and all sorts of my movement. I feel like I'm quite adaptable over the last few years. I've been playing right wing back. I can play as a striker role, and I can go into the left as well. So I can offer quite a few positions and that aspect.
That's Martin Boyle. And it's certainly not the Australian accent we're used to hearing.
Well, some of the Australians playing overseas actually tend to pick up the local accents. I mean, you listen to Mas Luongo talk these days after years with QPR and Swindon, and he sounds like a little London boy. So not something we're entirely not used to. But Martin Boyle, as a Scottish citizen, he's got to get some paperwork in order if he is to turn out for the Socceroos. And here's what he had to say on his citizenship process.
Yeah, obviously my father was born in Sydney all that years ago, and he immigrated over to Scotland. Obviously I was born there, but we've spoke about it multiple times before past years, but the situation where I was years ago, I never thought in a million years that would be my journey would come this far. A few years ago, if you told me that I'd be playing international football, I would have laughed at you. But you know, it's been an incredible journey, and obviously it's one I want to, yeah, I want to take it one step further and hopefully represent the country even more.
That's Hibs winger Martin Boyle, who has been called into the Socceroos squad ahead of their upcoming friendlies. And he won't feature in the match against Kuwait. Obviously, he's waiting his clearance to represent Australia. But he is certainly looking forward to putting on the green and gold.
Absolutely. And it's a little bit satisfying, I have to say, with Australia having lost so many players to, you know, countries from their parents' birth, or, you know, a lot of players are dual nationality and they choose to play for, you know, play country other than Australia. Most famously, Croatia, you know, has recruited a few Australian-born players in the past. So it is a little bit satisfying, I have to say, as a Socceroos fan, that we've got one back the other way. And Martin Boyle, he seems to be a quality player from all accounts. Here's what he had to say about the influence of Mark Milligan and Jamie McLaren, his Hibs teammates, who've been in his ear a little bit about representing the Socceroos.
Yeah, I mean, Jamie's been there the past year or so, and, you know, we always talk about it, and he always emphasises how good the squad is, how tight they are, the unit, and, you know, they're all great lads, and they're all playing to top-level football at the moment, and, you know, he was putting out the feeders as well, you know, speaking to Arne. But, yeah, and obviously Mark coming in, he's been a revelation for us. You know, he's been brilliant. You know, he's a standout fan's favourite at the moment. You know, just his composure on the ball, and, you know, the reading of the game, and, you know, he's one of a kind at the moment for us.
That's Martin Boyle. Now joining us on the line is Alan Patullo. Alan, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's okay. Greetings from Israel, where I'm still recovering from a dire Scotland performance last night.
Yes, I believe they went down thanks to an own goal, Alan. You're over there in Israel covering the internationals for the Scotsmen?
Yep, that's right. Yes. Yeah, a very poor result. So possibly Martin Boyle has made the right choice to go with Australia, I think.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about Martin as a player? You've seen a lot more of him than we have, given that you're over there covering the Scottish Premier League.
Yeah.
I believe Scotland were actually interested in calling him up and actually made a late play for him to switch his allegiance back to Scotland.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, Alex McLeish has been asked a lot about, the Scotland manager has been asked a lot about Boyle in the last couple of weeks. There was some speculation he was preparing to call him up a couple of weeks ago for these games against Israel and Portugal on Sunday. But I think he did make contact with Neil Lennon, and the Hibs manager, and he did speak to Martin Boyle. But I think it was really just to tell Martin that he's well covered in those wide positions just now, and, you know, that he wasn't going to call him up this time, and so if that meant Martin agreeing to go with Australia, then so be it. I think McLeish was quite phlegmatic about that, but certainly some Scotland fans, having watched last night's result, might be pining for Boyle, because he's certainly one of the informed players in Scotland, and I would suggest one of the most improved players of the last two or three years.
What's been the media reaction, Alan, and the reaction of the fans to him choosing to play for Australia?
Well, it's difficult. I think it depends, I suppose. It comes down to loyalty as well. Hibs fans, I think, seem quite up in arms. Hibs fans, obviously, they watch him week in, week out. They can see his qualities on a regular basis. I think a lot of the Hibs fans were quite disillusioned, perhaps, when Scotland didn't call him up. And so they can possibly understand why he agreed to join Australia, certainly, in the first instance. I know he's not going to play a competitive game, so I guess he could still switch allegiance. But from the more general Scotland fans, I don't know. I mean, Martin Boyle, he clearly has his qualities, his speed on the wing, and he can also weigh in with goals that he's scored, I think, three or four this season already. But I think some Scotland fans might be of the opinion that he's not quite got the quality for Scotland international football yet. I guess his background too. He came up from Montrose, where he started his career, played for Dundee, in and out of a Dundee team, and then was allowed to leave for free to go to Hibs. You know, it's been a slow burning career for Boyle. He's taken a while to come up the level. So I think some Scotland fans probably still need to be convinced about his quality.
Alan, we know he plays with some of the Socceroos at Hibs. How much of an influence do you think they've had on his decision?
Yeah, I'm sure they will have. I mean, I think you mentioned there in the clip he played. I'm sure they'll be in his ear in the dressing room saying, come with us. And what a great opportunity. What a fantastic opportunity for Martin Boyle to play international football. As I say, you know, I watched him at Montrose a few years ago, and you know, someone said to me then that he'd be playing international football for a good team like Australia, a fine team like Australia, and I'd be absolutely aghast. So I think great credit to himself. He really has put the work in to put himself into this position, and it's great to see somebody get rewarded for such work, and somebody who a few years ago was playing lower league football in Scotland.
Sounds like a bit of a fairy tale rise for Boyle. I mean, I'm just looking at Montrose here. They're in the third division of Scottish football. They're a semi-professional side. So, you know, even in the context of the Scottish first division, he's come out of nowhere a bit over the last few years.
Yeah, he absolutely has. And, I'm biased. I'm a Dundee fan. I watched him a lot at Dundee, and I loved watching him. He's it's always great to see somebody play with speed. You know, it's such a bonus for a side to have somebody with speed. But Dundee made the very odd decision to let him leave for free. In fact, I think we swapped him for a player called Alex Harris, who came to Dundee on loan, and who is now playing for York City in the sixth tier in English football. So Dundee definitely got the raw end of that deal, because Boyle since then has just improved and improved, and I think great credit has to go to, well, first Alan Stubbs, his manager at Hibs, who signed him, and then Neil Lennon. He's really blossomed under Neil Lennon in the last couple of years into a player where he has countries almost fighting over him.
And Alan, do you think that he will get his clearance? Obviously, we know he's awaiting that to represent Australia.
Yeah, well, I'm not too sure the details, but I don't see why not. It's an interesting one. Scotland, McLeish could be under pressure now to revisit this decision, you know, in the next ahead of the next doubleheader against Albania and Israel. You know, he might have to go back, cap in hand, to Boyle and plead with him to come back, perhaps.
Well, we've been involved in some of these international tug of wars from Australian perspective here, Alan. So I'm sure many Australian managers would sympathise with McLeish's position. But in terms of Martin Boyle's position on the field, he's a right-sided winger, we understand. But Matthew Leckie, who plays for Hertha Berlin, is probably one of Australia's most bankable players, and actually is pretty cemented in that spot. I mean, there's some talk that he could be used up front. Is Martin Boyle versatile at all? Can he play, you know, on an opposite wing or as a forward?
Yeah, I think he can. I mean, I personally like to see him play on the wing, you know, where he can use his speed to full effect. But I mean, Neil Lennon has been playing him, in a front two, just behind the striker, Canberry for Hibs, and he started his career as a number nine for Montrose as a striker, and he scored a lot of goals for Montrose. I know again that that's talking about a different level there, but you know, I think that's possibly where he might prefer to play as a through the middle, and it gives a defence something to think about, doesn't it, playing against a striker with pace, and Boyle certainly has that. So, you know, I definitely think, you know, I would regard him as versatile, and he can play probably anywhere along that along the forward line.
Well, that will be music to the ears of Socceroos fans, Alan, because we've struggled for goals recently in the Australian team. But speaking of some of the other Aussies applying their trade over in Scotland, you've got Jamie McLaren and Mark Milligan now doing the business at Hibs. And over at Hearts, Ben Garuccio starting at left-back, and Oli Bozanic making some appearances here and there. It's been a bit of an Aussie takeover of the SPL this season.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see this. And I think the player you mentioned first, Milligan, for Hibs has been a really, really inspirational signing. Somebody who I know, and this is embarrassing for football fans in Britain and Scotland, possibly don't know too much about him. I know he's a bit of a legend in Australia, but he's come in quite quiet fashion, really. And in the last few games, you know, playing that anchor role in midfield and really has given has really buttressed Hibs. They've got a great defensive record recently. They've not been conceding a lot of goals. I think if you ask a Hibs fan who's had the biggest effects on their season, and a lot of them might plump for Milligan. And in terms of McLaren, that's obviously disappointing. He's injured just now, and I think he's going to be out for a few more weeks. But you know, the Hibs fans who have already relished a fantastic start to the season, you can look forward to McLaren coming back into the team and hopefully forming a partnership with Canberra like it did at the second half of last season again.
Well, Hibs are having an astonishing season ahead of Celtic in the table. They're second just behind Hearts. How have you seen Ben Garuccio go this season? He's a bit of an attacking left-back. People are a little bit surprised when he made the move abroad from the A-League and was starting games straight away because, you know, maybe people didn't think he was good enough defensively to make it in Europe. But how has he performed so far this season?
Yeah, I've not seen as much of him as I'd like to yet. But I've heard good reports from Hearts fans about him, and you know, again, it's a case of a young player looking at Hearts, and you know, there's a few of that type at Hearts under Craig Levein, and you know, getting a chance to play in Hearts again. Well, we're talking about Hibs. There's Hearts, top of the league. So they must be doing something right. And you know, Garuccio and Bozanic, I think I'm right in saying they both scored in a recent under 20s. Win over Hibs, the two free kicks, I think. So that was good for headlines here, with the two Aussies scoring to down Hibs.
Well, Alan, we must thank you for joining us here on Evenings on FNR. It's great to have an insight from a Scottish perspective into the Martin Boyle story, which has really intrigued and captivated Australian football fans recently. And we can't wait to see him in a Socceroos jersey once that clearance comes through.
Yeah, well, no, I'm looking forward to seeing that too, and I think he deserves it. He deserves a chance.
Alan Petullo, the sports writer for The Scotsman, joining us from an airport in Israel after Scotland's European League of Nations defeat. They lost to an own goal 2-1, so a disappointing trip for Alan, but he is excited about seeing his former Dundee United favourite in Martin Boyle playing international football, which would have been unthinkable a few years ago.
I think he can only be tied to the Socceroos when he plays a competitive game.
Yes, which has been the case for the last few years in regards to the FIFA rule. So if he plays a friendly, people keep saying this with regards to certain players eligible for multiple teams, especially during the Arzani.
I know, you know, it was funny when that happened because as soon as he played the friendly, everyone on Twitter was like, oh, he's ours. And I was like, no, guys.
Cap him, Louise.
He's got to play in a competitive game.
It is very frustrating. But you assume, and this is the case with most players, that once they do play in a friendly, they're pretty much locked in. Although, not always the case if you ask Brazil and Diego Costa.
And given the fact that Scotland have just come off the back of a loss, maybe it might give them something else to, you know,
yeah,
talk
think about
now well. That Martin Boyle, a player who's scoring goals over there, is off to Australia.
Absolutely. And, you know, Alan mentioned there about McLeish maybe having to go back hat in hand and say, yes, I'm going to select you. But it seems as if, based on, you know, his interview responses, Boyle has pretty much got his heart set on playing for Australia now. So that's great to hear. And I'm really, you know, really heartened by the fact that he can play in multiple positions, you know, behind a striker, up front, or on either flank. It's the kind of play we really need in the Socceroos squad to add some potency to that attack.
Especially moving forward into this new four-year cycle. It was interesting, though, to hear Alan call Mark Milligan an inspirational signing.
Yeah, absolutely. Terrific for Mark Milligan. At the age of 33, he's finally got that dream European move. After so many struggles getting a work permit in England, he doesn't have a European passport or heritage like so many of the Socceroos players do who play over there. And he tried to to move to Crystal Palace and Melbourne Victory blocked it, and I probably wouldn't have got a work permit anyway, and then he couldn't get through to Bolton. But he's in Scotland now and going about his business in his typical, quite unassuming way, protecting the back four, and it's fantastic to see that he's having such an immediate impact.
It is fantastic to see. And something that has come up is that Mark might not be ready to hang up the boots just yet, but he's actually revealed the next stage in his career and what he'd like to do.
Don't keep me in suspense, Louise.
He is going to take up coaching.
Oh, well, there you go. I can imagine that, actually, given that his temperament. I thought you were going to say something really left field, like winemaking or something. But Mark Milligan, he's always been a captain in so many of the teams he's played for, so that makes sense to me.
It does, and he's played under, you know, quite a diverse range of mentors, such as Gus Hiddink, Ange Postecoglou, Graham Arnold, Kevin Muscat. The list goes on, and he feels like he's really got a good grounding to, you know, have life after football in the coaching realm.
When you play for 10 different clubs and you have over 70 caps for Australia, you've got a bit of experience under your belt and a lot of different mentors to draw from. So remember, he went to the 2006 World Cup when he was very, very young. He was a bolter to Gus Hiddink's squad, but Gus saw something in him, and I think that's been borne out by his career.
It has, and he actually quoted Mark Milligan saying, "Coaching has been a burning passion of mine since I was a teenager," which is pretty unusual. That was his quote.
Yeah, I mean, if he's been like some players do get involved at a young age, you know, in their clubs and so forth, coaching youth teams and getting involved in that side of things. And you know, I think a lot of players, on the other hand, don't think about it until the very end of their career, and then they have to suddenly start doing their coaching badges and, you know, almost rewiring their brain to think a different way about football. And it's difficult to make that transition. So if it's a long-held passion of his, I'm sure it'll make it a lot easier for him.
That's it. And I think he's really drawn to basically different, you know, tactical philosophies that he's come across throughout his career. And I look forward to seeing what happens after he finishes his football career.
Well, Louise, I do have some breaking news from the Central Coast friendly match. The Mariners have scored. It's not Usain Bolt, though. It's Ross McCormack, who knows how to put the ball in the back of the net.
Was it a Usain Bolt assist?
We don't have that information currently, but let's hope so.
And it's great that he is playing alongside the likes of Ross McCormack, because we know he has EPL experience. He also has experience in the Championship, and that would be invaluable for Bolt at the moment.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, it's only just got underway, but that goal, we can confirm, is actually a free kick from distance. So no Usain Bolt assist, but pretty standard Ross McCormack.
Very
fair.
Standard.
Louise, we must take a short break, and when we come back, a bit more Socceroos chat, and we might even have an update from our Fantasy Premier League. Nick Debano on the panel is shaking his head. He doesn't want to reveal it, how low he stands in the rankings. I'm sure we'll make short work of that resistance from Nick Debano. This is Evenings here on FNR Football Nation Radio with Josh Parrish and Louise Taffer.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR, and that was our final break for tonight. And before we wrap up our Socceroos segment, Josh, fittingly, an article has come out about Andrew Naboot, and it's great to hear that he is finally back and playing in the J-League after he suffered that awful shoulder injury during the FIFA World Cup in Russia.
It was really heartbreaking to see, especially that post-game interview when he was clearly holding it awkwardly, and he was so desperate to try and be fit for the third game against Peru, but you could tell that just wasn't going to happen because it's a dislocated shoulder, takes several weeks to come back from. And good to see him playing back in the J-League for a huge club like Uwara, who have probably the best fan base in all of Asia, or at least they'd be a contender for that title.
Yeah, exactly. And he actually mentioned that when he did his shoulder, it felt like every ligament was tearing every second because it was out of place. And he said that after he spoke to the doctor and physios, they told him it would be 6 months. So he tried to get lots of different opinions, but it was all the same answer.
Yeah, that's pretty nasty stuff. I believe you've also got an injury update from one of the Matildas players.
I do. 24-year-old Matildas defender Steph Catley has had surgery following the match with England. She said it's an injury she's had for a little while, about 3 or 4 years, and she's just been going along with it. Mm. But now that they're going into the FIFA Women's World Cup, she doesn't want anything to hold her back, and that's why she's gone in and had a little clean-up.
Well, it's pretty scary stuff when you see the workload that especially Steph Catley has had to go under. I mean, there's a stat we keep repeating about what she had 2-3 days off in the entirety of last year, which is absolutely ridiculous. So hopefully you can deal with those niggling injuries. But it does worry me slightly in women's football that they play for, what, 2-3 club teams plus international football. And it's just like the endless travel and endless games. There's not really an off season for women who want to make it professionally a lot of the time. So it is concerning. And from a, you know, a physical preservation perspective.
Yeah, that's it. And I think when and as we start to bring women's football up to the standard that it should be, you know, and when these players are earning the right amount, then they won't have to travel as much.
Absolutely. Well, Louise, we will leave it there because I don't want to leave Nick Tabano and Athos Syrianos off the hook. Yes, they have been anonymous this program, but they are in studio, Nick on the panel, and Athos brilliantly running our social media for us. But I believe when I was away, guys, switch your mics on, I believe that you've pretty much ignored the Fantasy Premier League. You've not wanted attention to be drawn to your lowly status in this FNR competition.
Good evening, Josh. False bravado. No.
I'm 12th, by the way. So
I'm,
you know,
16th, but as I said, slow but steady. It's like the hare and the tortoise. We're starting slow, but we're building. Is that right, Athos?
That is very right, even though we are, what, nine
weeks in? I got 62 points last week from a guy that started on the bench scoring 2 of my goals as a captain in Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. So I think that's the start of good
and
things to come.
You've been his biggest advocate so far this season, and you've left him on the bench.
No, I'm starting him. What do you mean leaving him on the bench? So he started on the bench for Arsenal.
Oh, there you go. That's quite an impressive return. But the player I want to just quickly, speaking of forwards, Mitrovic from Fulham, has got 3 tasty fixtures coming up. They play Bournemouth, Cardiff and Huddersfield. He has dropped in price, so I'd recommend getting him in.
They are tasty fixtures, and you know, Alexander Mitrovic, he's big enough to eat some of his central defensive opponents, so he could be lapping up some goals.
Well, he's been a great servant in what's been a disastrous year for my team, but I've actually made 2 transfers. I had 2 free transfers for totally avoiding my team for that 1 week, as you said, Josh. I've brought in Doherty from Wolves. I think he's been one of the best defenders in the fantasy land. I've decided to take a bit of a punt on him and bring him into the side. And also, I have brought in James Maddison from Leicester with Ryan Sessegnon, who has really disappointed me. Fair to say, his season has been...
This is no bueno for me.
No bueno.
I think that drop's going to get a lot of mileage. That's our friends over at the PSG podcast earlier today. A little sound bite that got our attention. But Nick, you've been boasting about, what, 62 points?
62 points.
We've got to pay tribute to those in our fantasy league who are going above and beyond and really achieving great things. Joshua Main has put out 81 points over the past
game
week.
That's nearly double my score.
He's Captain Hazard and he's got Wilson and Aubameyang up front with Alonso chipping in with a handy clean sheet as well. That is absolutely phenomenal. And the leader in the Fantasy Premier League standings, the FNR standings that is Jacek Pendecky with his team Point Cook victory, picking up 77 points to solidify his lead at the front of the pack.
And second on the table, Ethan Stilos with the Mourinho way, getting a total of 53 points. Once again, Eden Hazard being the man as the captain with 28 points all up. If you had him as your captain, you would be laughing. Athos, your brother Jimmy has really dropped off. The Rowdy Misfits were the strong starters, but they've just absolutely dropped off. And Bulleen Lions, well, it seems like their fantasy team is quite similar to their men's soccer team because they are dropping into the relegation zone. Sorry for that one, Bulleen, but you guys went down and we have to make the reference.
Oh, that hurts. I'm not even involved with Bulleen and that really stung. Apply cold water to the burned area. I did have Hazard as my captain this week, having just transferred him in, and he is the informed player, not only in the Premier League, but in Europe. I think if you've still got Salah in your team and you haven't transferred Hazard in place of him, I think you're kidding yourself, if I'm honest.
Are you?
Yeah, Salah's not scoring goals. Yeah,
Salah's been poor.
Salah so far has gotten 42 points in fantasy. Hazard 74, 24 no ahead of the next best in Raheem Sterling. I've got Sadio Mane in my team, and he's had a bit of a dip in form, so I might consider getting rid of him, although I do not have enough to get Hazard in the team, so I might have to hold off for another week there.
I'm very disappointed with Roberto Firmino. 2 goals this season only. Mm. I'm not happy. But
he did cop a finger in the eye.
But he scored then against PSG days later. But their next 2 games, Huddersfield and Cardiff, that's looking like feed me more territory for Roberto Firmino. I think he's going to go to town. In his next 5 games, it includes also games against Fulham and Watford with 1 hard game against Arsenal away. Mind you, just talking about the Gunners, I was actually looking at Alexander Lacazette as well, a guy that really has had a great season, I've thought, so far, and was very good against Fulham. So if you want to look at someone in your front line, I think he's definitely a guy to keep your eye on.
Now, the big question is, do you captain Hazard this week? They're playing against Manchester United. Ooh. You know Mourinho will double mark him and assign somebody to just kick his shins
probably
every time
Mateo
he gets the
Damian
ball.
To play a, or Ander Herrera to
yeah,
play as a
it'll probably
role.
Be Herrera. It's usually Herrera in that role. Do you captain him against United? Do you back Hazard to come through that scrutiny and that pressure and score? Or do you go with someone like Firmino or Mane or Aguero, who are all
or Aubameyang?
Aubameyang
will start on the bench and then score 2 goals again.
Yeah,
so
it should be
Aubameyang
fine.
Should be the safe bet. The Gunners don't play until the 22nd of October, so a massive 10-day break there.
Oh, it's international break.
It
this
is
weekend,
the international
so I guess
weekend.
We have a bit more time to.
All right,
to
we've got some time.
We
to,
do have
to
some time to
over.
Discuss. But if I was to say, I think I'd captain Hazard. It's at the Bridge. He's a big game player. At he'll lift. I'd say I'd captain him.
But it's like it's worrying. Athos, they're going to tag him.
Fantasy success is built on risk-taking, Nick. And if you want to climb up the
you
ladder...
You can't talk. You're last.
Well, that's why I'm going to take a risk this week. I'm going to captain Sessegnon from Fulham, I think.
No, I'm going to consider captaining Edison. I think he's going to get a clean sheet and save a penalty. So I reckon he's going to
I think that's the quote of the night. Fantasy success is built on taking risks, says Athos Syrianos in last place in the FNR Fantasy
And the
league.
Guy who's criticising the most is second last in Fantasy Premier League.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for jumping on the mics at the end there. Louise, thank you for bearing with us during that last 10 minutes when you totally tuned out and didn't really pay much attention. But I'm sure, you know, Athos and Nick's antics is not much interest to you.
And before we go, Melbourne City are up 2-0 over the Western Sydney Wanderers at the moment.
Has Kieran Backer scored?
No.
Has he been sent off?
No.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait and see. And Central Coast Mariners have scored another goal. Tommy Orr's precision cross finding the head of Ross McCormack. He scored a diving header, guys. I didn't know Morris McCormack could move that way, but it looks like he's
obviously can.
He's in for a huge season.
When the ball's placed on his head as well as that, you don't really have to move much, do you?
No, not too much. Tommy Orr, the assist king. It was. I'm looking at the replay here, Nick.
Was it really?
It was a diving header.
Did he just like slide along the ground?
No. It was perfectly placed in the corner.
Big Ross is getting the job done.
And he will do in the A-League this season. We must leave it there. Thank you very much to all of our listeners for tuning in and all of our guests for joining us. This has been Evenings on FNR, and we'll catch you again on Monday.
This is no bueno for me.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.